Meeting will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we hopefully will shortly. So we won't move the minutes yet. But members, we have one item on our agenda today. I happened to read about this. Representative Hansen isn't here, for example. We especially scheduled this to make sure he could be here. When I heard about the work that the legislative auditor had done on general obligation bond expenditures, I understood they looked at the 2006 bill, and there were a number of findings. And at the end of that report, I saw that they, in all likelihood, said they wouldn't do this often because they didn't think they had the money for it, and I thought then it is to our advantage to take advantage of the one they have done to see if there's anything we can learn from it. And so they're here to make the presentation today. We've invited all of the agencies mentioned in the report, and so if any of you have questions of them, they're all in the room and prepared to come forward, and certainly we would invite any of them at the conclusion of the legislative auditor's report, if they would choose to come forward, that we're open to that. So I did want to call to your attention that the Office of Management and Budget has already responded with one change item. And there's a sheet in your packet that references that, Financial Oversight and Assistance. And at the bottom, you see bonding oversight. The second element of this initiative would significantly expand the state's capacity to manage state bond authorizations. So I think that they referenced the report, highlighted the need for a fresh review of the implementation of bond appropriations, and so there has already been action taken by that office in response to the report. So are we at a quorum now? No. So we'll ask Mr. Nobles, and is it Mr. Reedy, to come forward, or is Mr. Nobles handling it? Have I pronounced that name correctly? Welcome to the committee. And Mr. Nobles has indicated, I asked whether he'd prefer to give his entire report, and he's, I think, indicated he doesn't mind being interrupted if you have a clarifying question along the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Jim Reedy. And we are very happy to be with you and appreciative of this opportunity. We really see what we engaged in here as part of a process, a very important process. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, it's something that we have not done recently, and I'll talk a little bit about that and why, as you also mentioned, it may be something that we will only be able to do on a collective basis, although I think the degree to which we do that will depend to some degree on how useful the legislature finds this kind of audit work. Let me just back up a minute and remind you, although I've said this to a number of you in other committees, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does a variety of things. We have a financial audit division and a program evaluation division. The program evaluation division does only work in response specifically to requests from the legislature, and those topics are approved by the Legislative Audit Commission on an annual basis. In our financial audit division, we also do quite a bit of work that is mandated, that we're required to do by law. The biggest piece is the statewide audit, which is an audit of the state's financial statements, and we have to do that on an annual basis as well. We also have responsibility to audit on behalf of the federal government, the state's use of federal funds. And we have a number of other audits that we have to do on a regular basis. So at the end of each year, we're left with some resources that we can sit down and decide how we're going to deploy them. And typically what we do is that we look at all of the various organizations that we have jurisdiction to audit, and there are about 150, 160 of them. And we want to give them some audit coverage as frequently as we can. And so every year we select 15, 16, 17 of those, and we go out and audit them. But one of the things that we've talked about as we go through that process is that there are some important functions in state government that are not isolated just to one entity. They cut across state government. And so we try to get to those as well on some periodic basis. For example, I think it was last year, year before last, we did an audit of professional technical contracts, which involved a number of state agencies. And so as we went through our risk assessment and decision-making process most recently, I proposed the idea that we ought to look at GO bonds, because I know that the legislature puts a great deal of effort into deciding what is going to get bond funds. You go on a lot of tours and you go through a very detailed decision-making process. And then in law, you say with some specificity and precision exactly how you want that money to be used. And as you all know, our mission as an office is to strengthen not only accountability and good financial management in state government, but also to strengthen legislative oversight. So we felt that we had some obligation on your behalf as the legislature to undertake an audit that would extend our arm into how these bond funds were being used, specifically whether or not they were being used as you had specified in state law. So we took a sample, and Mr. Reedy is going to talk about that scope and what we found. But one of the things I want to mention is that we realize that we're not going to be able to do this on a very frequent basis. And so there really needs to be a mechanism, ongoing mechanism, in state government that ensures that what you have said in law gets carried out. And that's why we called in our report for a stronger role from the Department of Finance. We really look to the Department of Finance, and the Commissioner of Finance specifically, as the Chief Financial Officer of state government. And as you undoubtedly know as well, the Commissioner of Finance receives advice from legal counsel, bond counsel, that the state of Minnesota specifically hires to help the state ensure that we are not only complying with state law, but the constitutional restrictions and parameters that are put around what we can bond for. And so we had a meeting with the Department of Finance, the Commissioner and his staff, and as you indicated, Madam Chair, they embraced that, and they've made some proposals that would strengthen their role in ensuring that the bond funds are spent in accordance with the constitutional requirements as well as the statutory requirements that you put into place. So with that, Madam Chair, I think I will turn it over to Mr. Reedy to go through some of the details of what we found.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Reedy, and I was the audit manager responsible for our audit of the general obligation debt expenditures for the state of Minnesota. I wanted to introduce the staff that were key to the preparation of this report as well, and they're in the audience today. Amy Jorgensen was the lead supervisor on the audit, and David Westlund was the lead worker who assisted Amy with the work that we did. There were a lot of our staff that were assigned to this audit, but they were instrumental in the work that we did on this report. The other thing I wanted to say is we're really happy to be here. We're always excited when there's interest in the work that we do. As Jim said, this is a very challenging assignment for us. As you mentioned, we focused our work on the 2006 bonding bill, and there were a couple of appropriations of about $1 billion in that bill that was authorized in the 2006 laws of Minnesota in Chapter 258. The scope of this audit was very large. We actually audited 13 different entities, including the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, or the Department of Finance, as they're currently known in law. Part of that work covered executive branch agencies. One of those agencies was MNSCU, but even within MNSCU, we audited 12 different colleges and universities and their facilities management unit. So in total, we looked at about 25 different entities, if you look at it that way. Of the $1 billion of capital projects that were included in the bonding bill, we focused on 60 different appropriations that were administered by the number of entities I just mentioned. In addition to the executive branch agencies, we extended our work to some of the component units of the state of Minnesota. That would include the University of Minnesota, the Department of the Metropolitan Council was another example, and the Housing Finance Agency. We also did some work at the Minnesota Historical Society, which, as you know, is a nonprofit organization, not really a government organization, but they do receive a lot of bonded money as well. At the time that we did the audit, there was about $385 million that had been expended in the 60 appropriation accounts that we looked at. And overall, our conclusions were that the controls were adequate to provide reasonable assurance that the state's resources were adequately safeguarded, that there was accurate financial reporting for the money that was involved, and that the expenditures complied with legal provisions. But having said that, we still had $1.5 million of question costs as a result of this report, and I want to talk about some of those in detail. And in the end, as a result of the findings we had, we did feel that there was a stronger oversight role that was necessary to protect the state's resources. So with that, I want to start talking about some of the findings. I'd really prefer to wait to talk about the oversight finding, which is finding number one, after I have a chance to give you some flavor for some of the issues that we identified as a result of the work. So I was going to start with finding two, and that's on page 8 of the report. And in this finding, we talk about questionable costs of about $806,000. As I was preparing the remarks today, I was thinking, you know, the $1.5 million in total that we questioned was just based on the sample that we did. So, you know, if our sample was representative, you'd think that there could be question costs of around $4 or $5 million, actually. But we focused our findings on the problems that we found with the specific transactions that we tested. This finding is actually fairly straightforward. I think for the most part the agencies that were cited in the finding agreed with the findings, but I wanted to give you some examples of some of the things that we found that resulted in us questioning the cost. Some of them are pretty straightforward. $390,000. The Met Council was reimbursed for a project that was not authorized in the bonding bill. It was actually due to an accounting error, and we recommended that they reconcile their accounting system to the state's accounting system. I think that would have prevented that project cost from being reimbursed by the Department of Finance or MMB. The Historical Society also had a project of about $190,000. And that work was for pre-design work, and again, as Jim had mentioned, the statutory language in the bonding bill can be very precise, and in this case, pre-design was not contemplated in the language that authorized the appropriation. Another area...
Is it to that point, Representative Scott? Yes, Representative Scott has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, the $390,000 error there, can we get that back from the Met Council?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, they did reimburse the accounts for that. A lot of these projects are actually split funded from a variety of sources, so there were funds available within the Met Council's structure that they reimbursed the money in that case.
And Madam Chair, I might just add that on some of these findings, it's not a matter of our conclusion that the money was spent for some illegal or inappropriate purpose. In that sense, there may not need to be repayment. It's that they may have used it the wrong fund. So it can be a mix. I mean, obviously, we do come across situations where we think there's an expenditure that is just inappropriate because there's no good public purpose, and so it shouldn't be paid out of any public fund. But I think what you're going to hear is that because of the way the bonding bill is put together and some of the parameters that are put around the use of bond money, either from the statutes or even the Constitution, you have to be careful about the very specific things you're using that money for. And to tell you the honest truth, sometimes it's not intuitive. I mean, you think you're doing a good thing, you're accomplishing a public purpose, but you have to be really careful, again, because of constitutional and statutory restrictions, that the thing you're doing, the very specific thing that you are doing with that money, falls within what the legislature authorized or the Constitution permits.
And members, we have occasionally run into municipalities or others who have thought, we can just switch. Yes, we authored it for this, authorized it for this, but our plans have changed, and now we're going to use it for this. And in fact, you would literally have to cancel the bonds and reauthorize bonds for another purpose. Representative Carlson lived through that with Bonneau Boulevard, as you may recall, that it had been authorized in one particular way, and we canceled bonds and reauthorized. So it is not often understood that it requires that formal step.
And Madam Chair, if I could just pick up on that point, and I don't mean to interrupt Mr. Reedy too much, but that's a very important point to make, and that is when we are out as auditors, we are looking at what the law authorized. And when finance is doing its job, it looks at what the law authorized. But what we sometimes hear from people who receive bond funds is that they have an informal understanding with certain legislators or a committee of the legislature that what they're doing is okay, even though it may not be strictly what the law authorized. You talked about using this audit as an opportunity to learn some things about the process. One of the things that we would advise is that if there is a change of intent on the part of the legislature, that you formalize that through an amendment to the law or a reauthorization. We find it somewhat difficult to deal with agencies telling us that they have these more informal understandings that what they're doing is appropriate and authorized. So that's one thing that we would ask for, and that is if there has been a change in what you want or the entity wants, that you formalize it. We know sometimes that can be cumbersome. But after all, if an agency or an entity of government starts to use the funds for some purpose other than what was formally authorized in law, we potentially have not just a confusion among auditors, but we may have a lawsuit that goes to an unauthorized use of bond funds, and I think that's something we do not want to occur. So,
Mr. Reedy, can I continue?
Thank you. Another example of some ineligible costs that I wanted to point out in this finding dealt with moving and storage fees. And there is a policy that the Department of Finance developed that precludes the use of bond funds for these purposes. And in total, we questioned about $100,000 from a number of agencies that were charging moving and storage fees to bond funds. Of course,
I forgot. Representative Hansen had his hand up too, and I'm sorry I didn't off. I think yours was to the previous point.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it follows on this point. Let's assume there are errors. Let's assume this was not some agreement, or assume that there's not malice here, but it's just an error on not knowing. Where is the review point, or where is the checkpoint? Is it the agency that receives the authorization and then finance looking over it, or is it just a random fact that you're coming around every 3 years and the auditor might catch this?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I think your question goes to why we recommended that finance take a stronger role in the process before the auditors show up and provide entities with more guidance and even monitoring, and to instruct them with some firmness if they find that agencies are proceeding to use bond funds for what could be an inappropriate purpose. So we think more upfront guidance, monitoring, admonition, and intervention will prevent some of the things that we found. And I think we'll come to even some more of those. And again, I think that this experience of doing this audit, I think demonstrated to finance that they need to play that stronger role, because I think we uncovered some things that they were unaware of. I think what they will tell you, and I certainly hope you will have an opportunity to hear from them directly, is that they have really emphasized their upfront role. They do try to give agencies guidance as money is being put out for projects, but they feel that they really haven't had the staff to monitor in a very direct way how the money is actually being used. And once the money gets out of the state treasury and into another entity's account, it may be more difficult for finance to do that monitoring, and they may need some more staff to do that.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, I just wondered, could you give a broad definition of what's enough change that it's out? In other words, on Botno Boulevard, as I recall, I think it switched from a busway to a rail, but what if it went from light rail to commuter rail or something like that? Or just what is the, what throws it off?
Mr.
Is there any?
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, I think it's what does the law actually say? I mean, what are the actual words in law that authorize the money to be spent? You know, again, as auditors, we prefer specificity. We prefer that you be fairly specific so we know clearly on the face of the words in the law what you intended. But it is true that on occasion you make a choice to give a broader authorization. So I could conceive of a situation where you might have given a legal authorization that could have allowed for either of the options you posed. I think we can give you an example or two, a real example or two, where we found that there was some question of whether or not an entity had taken the bond funds and used it for purposes that we thought were different than what the law said. And again, we take the law to mean your intent. And I guess I would point specifically to the Minnesota Zoo as an example of that. And so we may want to move to finding three. Are you ready
finding
to do
three.
That? Mr. Reed?
Finding three it will be. And it is a natural segue because the first finding actually dealt with capital appropriations, and the focus of the findings with the zoo was a little more narrow because a lot of the money that we looked at was specifically dedicated to capital preservation, and that's where some of the interpretation maybe comes into play. In total, we questioned about $700,000 out of the zoo's capital asset preservation appropriation, and in our view, some of the charges were ineligible. An example of that were new portable classrooms. The statute on capital asset preservation talks about no new buildings or purchases of land, no major improvements is the language. And again, the intent of the statute, as you well know, is to preserve the assets that the state already owns. In this case, those were new classrooms, and so we thought that that wasn't an eligible cost. Again, $107,000. Where we get into more of the interpretation questions were a couple of the projects that the zoo had undertaken. One was a new holding pool and surrounding area for the otters that were part of the Grizzly Coast new exhibit. And again, the zoo's response, they said, we felt we did a good job in an economic way of upgrading the capital asset at a reduced cost. But in our view, because of the very strict statutory requirement, we didn't consider that to be an asset preservation type of expense. Similarly, they did a lot of work on the Minnesota Trail, and we questioned about $430,000 in money. And I think it really brings the interpretation question to the forefront in this case, because it was a massive undertaking on the part of the zoo, and there was new construction going on, and there was some refurbishing of existing structures, but in the end, we felt that we couldn't clearly determine that that met the requirement of capital asset preservation.
Did you finish that thought?
The only other thing I was going to say, it really emphasized the importance of some reporting back to the legislature and the Department of Finance, too, and that was the other part of this finding. Generally, the zoo is exempt from some of the reporting requirements, and in this case, regarding capital asset preservation funds, the zoo's enabling legislation waives the requirement for them to report back, but the 2006 bonding bill specified that they did need to report back, So I think we would have been more comfortable if that reporting would have happened so that they could have told you how they spent the capital asset preservation money and would give you some feedback as to how they were planning to use the additional funds in the future. You know, the statute really anticipates that management needs to make some informed decisions and changes as to how they're going to use this money, because they may be confronted with some maintenance that they hadn't anticipated when the bonding bill was first authorized. So that makes a lot of sense. But again, in this case, the reporting back didn't occur.
And I don't know if anyone might have an answer to this, but what, as I'm listening to you, and I know all of these are good agencies who have managed bonding responsibly, I mean, there are lots of things one can learn from an audit. And it occurs to me that one of the things we need to ask ourselves is rigidity built in? Does language allow flexibility for the kind of common sense or cost-efficient change? And, I mean, that's the question that occurs to me about our role in this. I don't know if there's an easy answer for that.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that is one of the things that the legislature, and particularly this committee and its counterpart in the Senate, needs to think about. How much flexibility, how much discretion do you want to give? And I mean, over my years of working at the legislature, I've seen a mix, a variety. I mean, there are some projects where you have a very specific idea of what you want and what you don't want done with the money, and you say that with some specificity in the law. But there are other projects where you simply want something to be accomplished, a good public purpose, and you recognize that there may be some unforeseen complexities, and you want to grant discretion. So I think those are things to be thought through. And frankly, you may differ among yourselves as to how flexible or how rigid or how specific you want to be. But I think, again, our point to you is that once you go through that process, and we really respect that process and the hard work that you do in that process, the only thing really we have to go on as to how you resolved these questions is what you wrote in the law. Now, I know that there are some that would suggest that again, that there should be some means of informal communication, that there should be some attempt to go beyond what the statutes actually say or the session law actually says, to interpret legislative intent. But I think all of you know that gets to be a pretty difficult ticket to work through, because then you get into, is it going to be more what senators said the intent was, or House members said the intent was, individual committee chairs? What is the collective statement of the House and Senate with a bill that was signed by the governor that expresses the institutional process as to what was decided? So I will probably emphasize this point more than you want to hear it, but the law, what ends up bound in these volumes, is extremely important. And if you say things with a degree of specificity, we're going to decide that you came to that judgment for a reason that needs to be respected, even though the agency may wish you had given them more flexibility.
Representative Anderson had a question. I'm sorry if I overlooked you earlier. I don't know if it's to this point or the earlier point.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, you said in your opening statement that things have been, it's been a long time since you've had a audit on the bonding or on this subject and finance. And the reason I asked is because in this one-page paper it says here, it's been decades, several decades, since Minnesota has changed its staffing on bonding oversight and things. And so if you haven't been involved with this process for 20 years of looking at, and now we're changing the name of the Department of Finance to MMB, I mean, we're going through a metamorphosis and we don't even know what's gone wrong in the past to know where we're at today. And we're finding out that there have been things that have been going on that have been changing methodically. You've got lots of recommendations here, and I'm just concerned that this has been something that's not been changed going back into the 80s.
Madam involved, Chair, and, I would say, over a long time.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I mean, we did this because we thought it was an area that needed more attention because, as you just said, and we agree, it's been neglected in terms of the level of oversight we would like to give it. But having done it and realized the amount of staffing it takes to do this kind of audit work, I'm telling you quite honestly, we're not going to be able to be out there on an annual basis doing this kind of audit to determine whether or not agencies are in fact implementing your what you say in the statutes. That's why we think the Department of Finance is in a better position. But I think, frankly, having done it once and you holding this hearing says to all of the people in the audience and maybe even others beyond that you do take it seriously, that we do take it seriously, that don't wait for us to come back out 3 years from now, 4 years from now, or whenever we can do this again. Make sure that you give proper heed to the law, that you file reports that are required, that you understand the parameters in which you're working. And they are different than just a general fund appropriation. That's what we need to get through to people, that this is money that comes with tighter parameters, with more strings attached, not only because of what you say in the law, but there are some very real constitutional restrictions on the use of bond funds. That's why the state hires a very specialized bond counsel to give the Department of Finance and you counsel on whether or not you are staying within the constitutional restrictions when you authorize money expenditures to be made through bond funds. But what we're saying is that a lot of that discussion does take place up front as you think about projects. That consideration needs to be followed through as agencies are actually spending the money so that they don't go astray using their discretion and judgment to use bond funds when they should be using other money.
Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Mr. Nobles. In your opening comments, you also talked about how you're not sure or you were hoping that people would receive your reports, and I have to tell you that when I ever hear a report from you, I think it's just a wonderful thing because we then find out this is the outcome measurement that we need. And as funding gets tighter in the future, this is going to be even more important. And I noticed that the MMB has in their memo, they talk about tight operational budgets. So this is something that doesn't come cheap. It's the kind of thing that if we want to make sure that we're making good use of taxpayer dollars, we might have to spend a little money to make sure that these jobs are taken care of and the oversight is adequate.
Madam Chair, I agree that we have said on a number of occasions in some of our presentations about the conditions of financial management in state government that, yes, we understand in this very severe financial crisis that job one is to balance the budget, and we understand that that is going to take some cuts. But good financial management is more than just cutting budgets. When we're left with whatever is left after the cuts are made, we need to make sure that we're managing that money appropriately, with accountability, and staying within the terms of the law. I want to just add, though, partly in response to Representative Anderson's comment, that I think we ought to say here that even though we haven't been doing a lot of audit work in this area, and finance also recognizes that there needs to be oversight, that we, in our world at least, do not consider this what you might call a bad audit, where there are a lot of just really egregious findings. We found, and our conclusion reflects that, we found that controls were generally good. There needs to be some tightening up and some tweaking and some improvement, but this is not like some of the audits that you've heard from us. Yes, we need to do better, but let's be willing to say when things are not terrible, they're not terrible here. You know, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, there are agencies out there that are attempting to do the right thing. Department of Finance has attempted to do the right thing in playing its role. This is just a very complicated area, as we've said a number of times. it brings some added complexity and restrictions that need to be adhered to.
Representative Hanson, did I miss your hand? Did you have a second? Why don't we conclude with finding three and then...
Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind, I do have a few remarks regarding the discussion.
Okay.
I do want to say, you know, based on all the question costs we had here and as we talked to the agency personnel who were responsible for those decisions, I felt strongly that in each case they felt that they were being good stewards of the state's resources. It came through loud and clear. I actually got a phone call from a manager at the at MnDOT who was responsible for managing the construction budget for the North Star Corridor. And he was concerned that he had spent $690 on computer equipment inappropriately. And I had to tell him, you know, you're doing a great job over there. You administered hundreds of millions of dollars of bonded debt over time. I had another call from the director of the Public Facilities Authority. And he said, you know, you brought some things to light that we need to pay more attention to. And in that case, the question cost was $10,000. So I would say, you know, we had those discussions with the zoo, too. I mean, if you looked at their response, they said, you know, we did everything above board. We tried to keep everybody informed. You know, maybe they didn't cross every T and dot every I, but I think the intent of being good fiscal stewards was clear throughout the work that we did. The other thing that I wanted to say, and I'll touch base on this with a few of the other findings, but there is some opportunity for some policy kinds of discussions more with Minnesota Management and Budget than necessarily the legislature in terms of how some of the funds are administered and what kinds of restrictions exist. One of the things that was a little bit unclear to people is that there is a different criteria for bonded money as opposed to money from the general fund, for example, or operating budgets. A lot of times the purchases are still capitalizable, but there's further restrictions on the bonded debt. The capital assets have to be at least 10 years for useful lives. And again, that's because you don't want to be spending state resources over a 20-year bond issuance if you're not going to get that kind of value out of the assets that you're purchasing.
I will say we have often said to people, cash is a lot easier than bonding. A lot of flexibility to cash that isn't there with bonding. Have you concluded with finding three, or do you have...
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
The next area is finding four on page 10, and this deals with internal project management costs. And again, the criteria is a little more restrictive. In this case, Minnesota Management and Budget, formerly the Department of Finance, worked with bond counsel to determine when internal project management costs would be allowable uses of bond funds. And again, the concern here is that agencies would supplement their operating costs with bond funds where they should be paying for payroll costs and supplies out of operating costs and not using bonded money for those purposes. We questioned about $5 million. Primarily, it was the University of Minnesota and MNSCU that have facilities management offices. And what they did, instead of doing a very detailed cost accounting for the labor costs associated with the projects that they're internally managing, is they did an analysis, and in both cases they set a range for the fees that they would charge to the bonded funds for the internal project management costs. Again, some of the feedback we heard from the agencies is that, you know, with that specific criteria, they could contract out for this money and these services, and clearly it would be eligible for bonded funds, but it would not be the most efficient use of the state's resources because they feel they can manage those projects more efficiently and on a more cost-effective basis than they would if they would contract out. So that was one of the arguments that we heard repeatedly from those agencies that were charging internal project management costs to bond funds, and that's where I think the policy discussions will be forthcoming with MMB.
Representative Mullery has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Reedy, you bring up a point I was going to ask about. Why, and I've looked into it before, for instance, the inspection people that we have go out to projects to see that they're doing them right, and then they report back and authorize a a payment or whatever, if they're independent, they can, I'm told by admin, they can be paid by the bond proceeds, but if they're, for instance, staff of admin who are expert on that, they can't be, and it seems like that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Mr. Reedy?
Madam Chair, and Representative Mulry, those are some of the very discussions we had with people in the agencies that we were auditing, and I think that's why it's going to be important going forward to find out what level of services are being provided. I think there's examples where if you've got a function that's totally dedicated to a construction project, I think Minnesota Management and Budget believes that that would be an appropriate use of bond funds. Again, in the report, we say there was a lack of clarity and specificity. In a lot of cases, they were recommending to agencies not to use bond funds for payroll costs, but it wasn't happening universally. And again, based on MMB's discussion with bond counsel decided that there really needs to be a clear connection with those costs to the specific projects that have been appropriated. I'll give you an example. I audited at the University of Minnesota a number of years ago for our office, and we were looking at their physical plant operation, and they had a lot of very elaborate administrative procedures as to how they were going to charge their labor costs for facilities management down to work orders or changes and things like that. And again, what we're hearing, particularly from the big players like MNSCU and the U of M, is that those administrative procedures are very, they almost suffocate them in terms of how much effort it would take when in fact they are still trying to be diligent in how they're using the proceeds. I think MMB is going to be open to some discussions. I know MNSCU is looking forward and hoping that there can be a resolution somewhere between on the continuum so that there is direct relationships to the capital appropriations that you've authorized and the internal labor costs associated with getting those projects completed.
Representative Colbert.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ray, the Constitution prevents us from having the expenditure and then bonding for it and paying for it after it's been, before it's been authorized by the state. So we can't go back with bonding procedures and pay for activities that were, even though they may have been related to that particular project before the bonds were authorized. How do we then, when we are going to try to assign some of the cost of a bond to the ongoing operations, how do we get by that particular provision in our Constitution that requires the bond to be first and then the allocation of costs, and not go back and pay for staff that are working and hoping to get a bonding project?
Mm-hmm. Is that Mr. Reedy? Or
I hope my question is...
Is it
clear enough?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I think... you certainly need to check with bond counsel as to the reason they bring this as a constitutional issue and what parameters they draw around how you can use those monies. But I think there may be some element of it still with some flexibility that's more a matter of policy.
And
I don't think sitting here right now I'd like to offer a general opinion that on how you can solve that problem. It may be, there may be a general answer, but I think you ought to utilize bond counsel to help you with that.
And there might be either Mike Rolos or Kathy Cradell or Jim Showalter, I think, are all here, and that might be one of those, if you're
sure.
Later, that you might have something to say about.
But, you know, just on this finding four, and then we'll probably move on to five, so you certainly have an opportunity to hear from others. But I think, you know, the principle here, I think we all understand, and that is we don't want entities to build up a staff of facilities management that is involved in a variety of things, new construction or asset preservation not being the only one, but to be using too much of bond funds and relying on a stream of bond funds to, again, pay for the maintenance of that staff, even though their construction activities may have fallen significantly. So, again, they may have some ongoing need for that kind of staffing, but they shouldn't become too dependent, inappropriately dependent, on bond funds to support it.
Mr. Mullery.
Real quickly, Mr. Nobles, if they kept track of the exact time that they spent on it and then took that as a percentage of their salary, would that help qualify for the, like the inspectors that go out or whatever?
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, I believe that that could work. I mean, I do think that those discussions have to take place with all parties represented, including the people who are operating the facilities management units and MMB. We'd be happy to participate in some of those discussions. But I think there's an opportunity to find a compromise position without belaboring the detailed cost accounting that might be required under what the bond council has currently specified.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Murray's question, I too struggle with this in other areas besides bonding too, but specifically to bonding, I guess I would be troubled to see any bonding money going to internal salaries because of the number one, public dollars are already paying for that person to be there. If not for this bond project, they're already there. So we're paying salary and benefits for that person to be there. And so if you're then put bonds on top of it, we're paying twice for that entity or billing it through the department. They're using it internally for other things, clearly. But even above that, you're paying more because bond funds have interest to pay back. And so I think, I don't believe for most, you know, and even hiring outside consultants, obviously that's a different story, but even that's I would question different ways or mechanisms to pay for those salaries too, because again you're paying a salary that now you pay back over 20 years and it costs you more, and you're already paying for it anyway if it's someone who's on the payroll and there anyway. And we run into that all the time, members, on other things too. An example which we can all relate to is I've asked how come we don't have a cable TV hookup in our offices. Some people do. And we call admin or whoever we call, and they say, yeah, you can do it, but it's going to cost the house budget X number of dollars to bring the state-employed electrician over to run the cable. But we're already paying for that electrician. He's on the payroll. He's not going to, or she is not going to be fired. You know, and so we do a lot of this shifting of funds and trying to bring monies into our departments that I think go beyond what the actual purpose is paying that personnel cost, but rather goes to running the department. And as you've seen through this report, paying for supplies and moving expenses and all kinds of other things that airfare, one of these paid for airfare. I mean, they're taking it in and trying to utilize it to pay other budget items. So I think it is troubling, and I think we need to be very careful and watch our folks, especially when they're paying salaries out of bond funds. In all deference to Representative Mullery, I don't think it should be done at all. Okay, Madam Chair, I think we raised an issue that you'll be dealing with in future discussions.
Mr. Reedy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, another interesting finding in the report is on page 12, and it's finding number 5. And this finding relates to a building purchase at St. Cloud Technical College. And again, there was an appropriation in the bonding bill for the college to purchase a building for $3.4 million. And what happened is that at the point that they were trying to finalize the sale, the owner of the building decided that they needed some time to relocate their operations. And so NUSCU entered into a lease for 3.5 years. And they actually leased 85% of the property to it was a Health Partners operation. And again, by constitution, the requirement is that any purchase with bond proceeds meets a public purpose. And by statute, the requirement is that a government program be operated out of that operation. NUSCU feels very strongly about this finding and didn't agree with it in the report. I think the view really is whether or not it's a long-term or a short-term view of the decision. And again, we're not questioning the reasonableness of this decision and the situation as it arose, but the Constitution doesn't say public purpose that is 3.5 years out or 1 year out or 10 years out, and the statute doesn't contemplate a government program that might take that length of time in order to become operational. The other part of this finding is that in leasing back the property to Health Partners, Minsky will receive a total of about $1 million in lease revenues, and again, by statute, it's clear that that money needs to be returned to the debt service fund to pay for the debt service on those bonds. An interesting wrinkle to that aspect of the finding is that higher ed institutions already are responsible, as I'm sure you know, to repay about a third of their debt service, and the statute doesn't reference the one-third payment that Minsky would already be responsible for.
And members, I'm assuming you're always checking the responses in the back. Minsky's response is on page 38 and 39 for that finding. Representative Anderson has a question.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, I was just wondering if the monies had been, because of the finding, have the monies been brought back to, returned back to the, and the lease negated?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the lease has not been negated, and Minsky's response indicated that they would try to work with MMB to see if they couldn't use the $1 million in lease revenue as part of their one-third repayment, which takes place on any capital bonding projects that Minsky was appropriated money for.
And I'm seeing our higher ed researcher is nodding her head yes also.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to this, this was a point of contention between the Legislative Auditor's Office and Minsky, but I think we had a very healthy discussion about the different points of view. And we certainly felt, as Mr. Reedy said, that Minsky tried to deal with a situation as it developed with some unforeseen circumstances, and we don't accuse them of any ill intent here. But I just want to make really crystal clear that I think there is a principle at issue, and that is we don't want public entities to come to you and ask for bond money, go out and either build or buy a building, and then get into the real estate business. That's what happened here. It wasn't what they necessarily intended from the beginning, but that was their solution to the circumstances as they unfolded. So, if for no other reason, just to say to the world here, try to avoid what happened in this situation, because, again, agencies should not be coming to you, we think it would, in fact, be a violation of the constitutional restriction, that if they come to you and ask for bond money to either build or buy a building that they then do not use for a public purpose and lease it out to a commercial private interest and obtain rent or lease. That's what happened here, even though, again, I say, I don't think they had ill intent. They simply dealt with circumstances as they developed. And we believe that the long-run intent of Minsky is to turn this building into a classroom building and use it for a public purpose. But there is a period of time here when that's not the way the bond money and the building is being used.
Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, Mr. Noble, who audits the legislative auditor?
Well, periodically, we come to you, and I guess you do that through our budget hearings, but we also hire a CPA firm to periodically audit our office.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Noble, what is the recourse if someone finds, like in this case, but you have to come down with some audits where I think you're not right? What is the recourse of an entity that's been audited when you come down with an audit and find it? Can they just say, well, we think you're wrong and kind of forget about it, or what recourse do you have?
We have no, Madam Chair, we have no enforcement authority. We can only make recommendations. And as you see in this report, and you can certainly see in others, where an organization like Minsky disagrees with us, they may simply say, thank you very much, we're not going to do what you recommended. And other than you as a legislature or some higher authority in the executive branch imposing some consequence, we certainly cannot impose a consequence.
Okay.
So we have no enforcement.
It's a finding and a response, and we take that information, and if, I suppose if we felt there needed to be clarity in the law or something, that, that it would inform our policy setting here.
Well, I think, Matt, Chair, this is another example of the direction they did on the Green Acres program. We're taken and the legislation 2000 really messed up big time. And so I'm hoping, but that's not your fault. You just did what you said.
Well, actually, Madam Chair, just to be clear, there were a lot of things in the tax bill that were done that were not in response to our recommendations, and we can talk about that another time. We will certainly stand behind our recommendations because we think they were well-founded, although you can certainly disagree with them and not adopt them. But let's please be clear that there was a lot that was done in that tax bill that was not done in response to our recommendations.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I didn't know we were going to discuss tax in here, but Mr. Nobles, what about if, okay, they want to build a building at one of the tech colleges or something, and as part of that there's a cafeteria, and that's a small scale, and it could be a lot larger issue. After 8 years of a 20-year bond, they find they can no longer operate, they lease out the space to somebody to run it, or lease out part of it for NSP to come in and conduct classes or something that they were originally running. What happens then? Or
it's a good point, Madam Chair, members, Representative Mullery, and it's something frankly we thought of in our discussion, and that is there is a certain amount of space in public buildings that is leased out for a commercial purpose, but it's to support the public purpose of that building. My office is in the Centennial Building. There's a cafeteria space in that building that's leased out to a private interest. But it's not open on weekends when the public building is not functioning. They're not actually there primarily to serve the public meals. They're there to serve meals to public employees during their time of employment. So it is more a matter of what is the overall purpose of the building. Is there a public purpose there? And I think the point you need to look at here is that 85% of this building was leased out for a private purpose. So it was not just the fact that some of it was being leased out, but the majority of the space was being leased out. It is certainly something you should hear from MSQ on. Again, they have a very different somewhat different perspective on this, and so you can hear from them. But there may be other areas in state government. I mean, we took a very small slice, a very one-time snapshot, and we found this particular incident. We don't know what there may be others that you may want to become aware of.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just was going to follow up to Representative David that there is an accountability for the auditor with the audit commission, so that we do vote to renew appointments every 2 years. If there are members that have issues with performance, we have the commission where there are House and Senate, equal number of House and Senate members, equal number of Republicans and Democrats on the commission. So ultimately the commission oversees the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So if you have concerns now, the gavel goes from the House back to the Senate at our next meeting for 2 years. So but if you have some concerns, you can come to the commission or from Mr. Nobles, and if there's a concern with any staff members beyond Mr. Nobles, too, you can talk to me as the supervisor.
And Representative Hansen chairs that
And Madam Chair, I might just want to say, too, because I think it's an important for members of the legislature to understand that our process includes a protocol and a process for anyone affected by one of our reports to have an opportunity to review our findings. And we
And that is before you even publish, as I understand.
Absolutely.
They have an opportunity for that response before the report is even published.
And it's a very important part of our efforts to ensure we fulfill our principal goal, and that is to produce reports that are accurate and objective. And so agencies play an important part in that. We deal with some rather complex issues, and even though our auditors go into the agencies and look at a lot of documents before we put together our draft findings, we still want to present to the agencies and the people affected by our findings an opportunity to review them before they're released and give us the perspective that we heard from MNSCU, get a rather lengthy and I think a very healthy discussion with MNSCU, with the zoo, with the Department of Finance, and anybody else we review. And then, of course, they're given an opportunity in the formal final report to submit with our documents whether they agree or disagree. And certainly, when they disagree, we appreciate them putting forth their reasons for that. So you, as the audience of our report, get an opportunity to hear both sides of the issue.
Representative Rukavina has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And it isn't often I compliment President Hoover, you know, but, you know, I can remember as a little kid going over to my grandma's house and there were these old shanties along the railroad tracks, and I said to my dad, well, where are those there? And he said, well, that's Hooverville, Tommy. And then, you know, if there were holes in the bottom of your shoes, you call them Hoover eyes, and, you know. But President Hoover did one good thing. He signed in the law prevailing wage law, the Taft-Hartley bill. And in 2000, and actually Taft and Hartley were a couple of Republicans too, representing David. Good, you know, good Republicans. Anyway, in 2007, we expanded the prevailing wage laws in this state and gave the Department of Finance some new authority for controls in the Department of Labor and Industry, Mr. Nobles. And I was wondering, regarding prevailing wage on state projects and local projects, and keeping records and making sure, did you do anything to see that that law is enforced?
Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, not specifically so much on this, but as you know, we did an evaluation
prior to that,
right. Of prevailing wage, and we found a lot of issues and concerns, and I think that was some of what led to the changes that were made and the additional enforcement authority and resources that you gave the Department of Labor and Industry on the issue of prevailing wage. So I would, for those of you who are interested in what we found and what we recommended on prevailing wage, it's in a report that we issued.
But now, Madam Chair, my point being, Mr. Nobles, now I believe, and maybe finance can help me out, that they are, you know, the repository, I guess, of this information for both local governments and MNSCU and other state agencies to make sure that the records are there to enforce the law. So perhaps, and when you're looking at these bonding projects in the future, and finances, as you put here, are, you know, their internal control and compliance audit of laws, that you can see that everything's on the up and up in that area.
And before you came in, Representative Rukavina, Mr. Nobles indicated that this was a fairly time-consuming audit and that they're not likely going to be doing one of these for a while. But
Madam Chair, if I could just add,
Mr. Nobles,
we are still going to think about how, when we go into agencies, we can possibly cover bond money in ways maybe we haven't in the past. Doing it this way was indeed very time-consuming because we were dealing with so many entities. But we will be going to the Department of Transportation, to the Department of Health, and all of the various agencies of state government, and some of them receive bond funds, some don't. Now, we did extend our work into some entities that we typically wouldn't go to, like the Metropolitan Council or some others, but most of the entities that are covered here, we have audit jurisdiction over, and we may, even though not do exactly this approach, we may find a way that we can look at bond funds like we look at other kinds of revenue resources to ensure that they're being used appropriately.
Have we concluded with finding five?
I think we have, Madam Chair, and I think
so
we've really
one more.
Concluded. Unless you want to ask questions about that finding, I think it's
okay.
A fairly technical finding.
All right.
So, finding six?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't planning to, but it does relate to some reporting back to the legislature, so if you're interested in hearing more about
now,
that, I'd take questions
on that.
Were you
then going to, were you saying you were going to go through the other findings and then revert to finding one, or did I misunderstand you?
Madam Chair, that was what I was planning to do,
okay.
But actually I think what we covered during the discussion is a lot of the things that resulted in the first finding, the need for policy clarification, the need for additional oversight to ensure the appropriate use of bond proceeds. There were a couple of other issues regarding MMB's role in terms of oversight. I could field questions on that, but that concludes
Anderson.
Our remarks.
Okay, Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, finding six, I just read the recommendation that you give here is that the University of Minnesota should submit program plans and cost estimates to the chairs of the House and House Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, and the Department of Education to ensure the school district should submit pre-designed plans to the Department of Administration. Now, these recommendations that you give, I guess it's up to us then to take those recommendations.
And I will say these routinely happen. And Representative Solberg, you can... I know I always get copies of them, and I happen to know that Representative Solberg actually reads them carefully.
Well, I read them carefully, but I have my staff really, really read them carefully. This finding, I think, does pick up a point that needs to be addressed, and it probably should be done when the bonds or the projects first start, and from Department of Finance, whoever is doing it, is that these reports are necessary, because unless they submit them, we don't know about them. And so there are some that are missed sometimes, and there are occasional when we ask for additional information on a report. Usually they do a very good job, but the staff looks at them. But if they don't submit the report, we don't know about it. So there should be some way to get that up front that they understand that it needs to be done.
Well, they've concluded their remarks, and as I said, the agencies are all here, so if members have specific questions of any of the agencies, or if any of the agencies would like to come forward, or if the department... I would just invite anyone. You had any concluding comments or?
Madam Chair, I just want to say thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Informative. So we have Representative Solberg.
Well, Madam Chair, the CAPRA findings that they had with, I think it was with the zoo, where sometimes it doesn't make sense to say, oh, I'm going to fix it up, and then I'm fixing it up, and all of a sudden, it'd be better to tear it down or to add on at the time I'm fixing something up and make that decision later on. And is there a way that we can have the department give us some recommendations on that particular fund? Because I think that is a statutory designated fund. I mean, we still have to use the bond procedures for the purpose the Constitution uses, but sometimes it makes kind of sense, well, let me add on a little bit and use these funds if that makes more sense.
Well, and I would just reiterate, and I think it's a very good point, mm-hmm. Representative Solberg, members, and that is, I mean, we found ourselves sometimes having to say to an agency, the zoo or whomever, well, what you did was not inappropriate, was inappropriate within the terms of the law, but it didn't necessarily mean it didn't make any sense at all. It may have been a very common sense, even efficient thing for them to do at the time. But they were doing something that wasn't authorized in the law, wasn't contemplated in the law. And, I mean, you meet every year. I would suggest that some of these agencies, if circumstances change and they have the opportunity, they really ought to come back to you and clarify the authorization. I think that, in fact, we noticed in this audit that had occurred with some of the legislation that you had passed earlier. I think... there was one facility in Minneapolis that was a rather complicated capital project. Had to do with who owned the land, mm-hmm. and a lot of complicated things that we probably don't want to get into here. But I think clearly the people going forward saw that there was a problem, and they didn't want to get caught doing something that was illegal or unconstitutional, so they came back to you and said, we need to amend the original authorization. And you did that, so...
Sometimes it's just we draw these silos and we don't allow any flexibility, reasonable flexibility, to be built in or a process to be able to have that change without us being in session to be able to make the change. So I think if we look at some kind of a flexibility, particularly some of those general funds, the HEPA and the CAPRA funds, that would seem to be reasonable for the legislature to consider.
I think the department is indicating an interest in coming forward. Welcome. Ms. Cardell and Mr. Roloff.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Cardell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Treasury in Minnesota Management and Budget. This is my colleague, Mike Roloff.
My name is Mike Roloff. I'm an Executive Budget Coordinator, and the Capital Budget Assignment is part of my team.
How much time, Madam Chairman?
We concluded running short. We conclude at 4:15.
I don't want to not allow you to ask some questions, so I will give you just a very brief, because you've already alluded to some of the things that we've already tried to do in response to this audit. But let me just say, first of all, that we did welcome these findings, because it had been a very long time, and from a personal perspective, as a new person in this position, it was a very illuminating process for me to participate to the degree that I did. We have, as you indicated, already taken steps to begin to address these findings. I'm going to just touch on a few of them so that you know what we are contemplating, but we also tried to address some of it in PREPA specifically in our response letter. First, we have, as you, I think some of you know, maybe not all of you know, we know what, we do not have a person currently in our capital budget coordinator position. That position is vacant, and Jane Rankin has left for another agency. That leaves Mike to try to accommodate that with all of his other duties, and myself and Susan Garola, who comprise the sum total of the state's debt management staff. So we have proposed,
and we've been keeping you busy, unfortunately.
Well, and I wasn't going to point that out, Madam Chairman, but in fact, I could have been making more progress on some of these things, perhaps, since December. But in any event, we have looked at Jane's position, and we do want to post that position, but it's going to be modified somewhat, not be an executive budget officer position, where she would also have responsibility as a budget officers do for other agencies. I said she. I'm not assuming it's a she. But taking much more of an active day-to-day role in assisting agencies and the grant recipients in understanding and interpreting the law and what our policies are. And I don't know, Mike, if you want to offer anything more on that.
Girola.
No, I'll pass.
Okay. The second item is, Madam Chair, you've already alluded to, and that is the fact that we have, in the governor's budget, requested two additional positions. One of them is intended to be a person capable of performing an audit function similar to what the Office of Legislative Auditor has done. In no way, shape, and form is that person, is a single person going to be able to complete an audit of all of the projects, because literally there are, as you've seen from the project reports, there are thousands of open bonding appropriations currently. But we are hopeful, and we would like to work with them to try to perhaps utilize this position to do periodic selected projects on an ongoing basis, so that agencies will know that, yes, this is the year we're going to do these X number of projects. Yours is very likely to be one of them. The second position is one in which it is designed more to help us assist in transition. My colleague, Susan Garola, has been with the state for, gosh, at least 25 years. She will not be here forever. She has a vast repository of institutional knowledge, but we need to bring in someone to assist on a day-to-day basis with managing all of the financing programs. Currently, we do a very large GO program, the 911 revenue bond program, a master lease program, other lease financings that agencies ask us to do, the school, city, county credit enhancement programs. Those are the current ones. That does not include things that are proposed, things that we are looking at with each session. And so that is the second position, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. In terms of the issue with the use of bond proceeds for project management costs, or MnDOT likes to call them program delivery costs, we have almost completed the tally of a working group of all of the largest, well, not even the largest, because we're including the Historical Society and the Zoo, who are not necessarily always frequent or large recipients of bonding money, but we're putting together a working group together with myself, Jim Showalter, Ron Mobbitt, who's really the man who's most functionally knowledgeable about the state's accounting system and what it is capable of, Mike Roloff, to work through with bond counsel what is a workable policy, because bond counsel is quite firm in their view that those dollars need to be used in a way that are able to be directly tied to a capitalizable cost of a specific project. And we have some state agencies here who are very experienced with doing that level of detail on a project basis. MnDOT, again, is a good example because they receive a lot of federal money and they're required to do that. But other agencies do not have that capability. So we wanted to bring together a group and work cooperatively to develop something that can be consistently applied across state government. What else was I going to say? I just want to say that there are some obstacles to doing effective management. As I think, again, Mr. Reedy and Mr. Noble's point out, I mean, we don't have the same accounting system for all of the entities that take advantage of bond proceeds. So when things are posted on a University of Minnesota accounting system or Met Council, we don't share accounting systems. They don't speak to each other. And so that is an issue.
The one issue that came up today, and I heard it in Representative Solberg's comment too, what I just recall is Lucian Social Service coming to me one time and saying that really the requirements, the rules about bonding are such that they actually raise the cost of a project. And the end result of that was that MHFA came to us and said, can we use our own bonding authority, and we actually can lower the cost of projects. One of the things that I'm sensing is flexibility. I mean, a big capital project, there are unexpected things along the way. And what does happen when there is a common sense way to solve it, but we're not in session? I heard that reflected in a question that Representative Solberg had too. And there may not be an answer to it now, but is there a way to provide that flexibility that allows you to respond to the need for sort of an immediate flexibility?
Madam Chairman, I would really have to echo what Mr. Noble said, which is that the best piece of information that we have to rely on is what you wrote in a bonding bill. And I can tell you, again, just from my own almost 1 year now in this position, that is the greatest source of frustration for me and for those that are receiving bonding appropriations, because it is so frequently the case that what gets written into the bonding bill is turns out to not be what people really want to do. And, you know, there are ways when projects come through, for example, the governor's capital budget process. People are involved, you know, we're involved, our capital budget people are involved, and we have at least a sense of what it appears that the scope and the needs of the project are, but there are sometimes projects that don't go through that process, and we don't have a lot of knowledge about it. We try to deal with that when we go through Deb Dyson and Peter Watson from the Senate on the side-by-side, you know, comparison of the bonding bills, and we bring in bond counsel, we bring in the Attorney General's office, and we sit there and we go through that document and we try to identify. But the reality is that we can try to look at that language and figure out, yes, the way that this is written, it seems as though it is consistent with the constitutional requirements. But unfortunately, what we oftentimes cannot know is, in fact, well, what they really need this money for is pre-design work. And we may not know that at that point in time. So, you know, we try to be flexible. But it's difficult when you don't have much else other than what you wrote. I see no questions, and again, I would just invite if there are members of the audience who were intending to come forward, and
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone moving forward, and I see no further questions. The next Tuesday, oh yes, we do have somebody, and he just got the greatest compliment at a joint transportation committee with House and Senate. And the compliment was given him by Congressman Oberstar for an incredibly organized process of prioritizing projects and being ready.
Madam Chair, committee members, I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to tell you what wonderful auditors, legislative auditors are. I think they're very thorough. They went through our stuff with fine tooth comb, caught stuff that blew me away. When they came in, introductory meeting, I said, I'm really proud of my staff. I thought we'd do an excellent job. Well, I think we understand the tax laws and issues associated with bonds, and we're real careful. We advise other agencies as well on some of those issues. They found stuff, you know, that we easily corrected. One, it was just a pure error on our part, but other stuff just changing the implementation. I think they should be congratulated, and that's all I want to say.
Well, I absolutely agree. I've had occasion to watch that process close up as well. Would you please identify yourself for the tape?
I'm sorry. I'm Terry Coleman, Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority, and we got caught.
And Mr. Coleman, I was giving him a compliment when he came up, so he was probably distracted from it. Representative Erdahl has a question.
Not a question. I just want to echo the words of Congressman Oberstar and Mr. Coleman and commend you on the excellent job that PFA does in Minnesota.
And he probably wonders where his priority is right now.
Mr. Chair?
Who is it? Representative Chelsea.
I would move the minutes for January 20th.
Representative Chelsea moves the minutes for January 20th. Comments? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. minutes are adopted, and the next meeting is televised, and we're going to try to get a handle on what will be the impact on our committee relative to future bonding bills by the appropriation bond, and so it will be televised, but we don't have a room for sure, so watch your emails. Meeting is adjourned.